My name is Stanley Laham. I'm speaking to you from Florida. I obtained my doctorate from the Department of Immunology and Molecular Genetics at the University of Florida. And my doctoral dissertation was the discovery of a previously unknown virus of the retroviridae family.
And where did you spend most of your career?
Most of my career at the University of Florida, scientific career at the University of Florida. And then after I spent most of my time in private enterprise, I obtained my PhD in 1978. My doctoral dissertation was the discovery of a new virus of the retroviridae family, which is the same as HIV. The double-stranded RNA viruses that have reverse transcriptase in them, but of a different subfamily. So you could
Okay.
say I do have a medical background.
Okay, so the vaccines that are now being released and how they might be different to previous types of vaccine.
Now there are about four different vaccines that are being approved for use.
But what about types though? Because do they not, are they all the same type?
No, they're not. And the ones that I'm most concerned about are the Pfizer and the Moderna vaccines, because they are using a no novel technique. What they're doing, they're taking the messenger RNA from the COVID-19, what we call the SARS-CoV-2 virus, the messenger RNA that codes for the spike protein, which is what attaches to cells and allows the coronavirus to penetrate
Okay,
and infect cells. And they're injecting it directly into the public. This is basically what their vaccine is, and what they're hoping, what they're doing, what they've had results with, is that our own cells will take that mRNA and make the spike protein. This spike protein will migrate to the membrane of our cells. Our immune system will recognize it as a foreign antigen and mount an immune response, make antibodies. B cells will make antibodies, and T cells will be activated to destroy the cells that are showing this antigen. And that's the danger with those with that new technique, because this mRNA, it will be translated into protein. That's what they call the process of going from messenger RNA to protein is called translation. But it also may be incorporated in our own DNA by the enzyme called reverse transcriptase, which can incorporate the RNA that we're receiving, transform it into DNA, and insert it in our own genomes. This way, our cells are not only producing the protein, the spike protein from the mRNA piece that gradually disintegrates, but keeps on producing it because it has been incorporated in our own cell DNA through reverse transcriptase. And what I'm afraid of is that it may cause long-term autoimmune disease. And we've seen many examples of things like that in cases of chronic hepatitis, where the virus can no longer be detected, but the viral antigen is still on showing up on the membrane of liver cells, and we mount an immune response and we effectively destroy our own liver. There are other vaccines that are coming out, which I think are, would be a much better idea. As far as I'm concerned, I would probably not take the mRNA of Pfizer or Moderna, because this is the first time such things are being used. And the long-term consequence that may way outlast the corona epidemic are not known. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, so can you just give us an idea of, take us through again, what can go wrong with this kind of vaccine? How is it that your body starts to actually reproduce something that you set out to get rid of? And what effect is that going to have, if it happens, on someone's life as they move in towards middle age and old age?
Well, like I said, the main danger is that it may create some autoimmune diseases. A lot of our cells that will incorporate this mRNA will become recognized as foreign by our immune system. There is no guarantee once you get that vaccine which cells and which organs, you know, will pick up that mRNA and start producing the viral antigen. So because of that, you know, it's a big unknown. Take the example of polio vaccines. Two polio vaccines were developed, the Salk vaccine and the Sabin vaccine. They were tested for years, even though they're very conventional vaccines. One was a dead virus, the Salk vaccine, and the Sabin vaccine was an attenuated vaccine, which when we were kids, we got on a piece of sugar and we ingested it. And this is what the Russian vaccine, the Sputnik V, is has more or less replicated. What they've done, they've taken the same piece of mRNA that Moderna and Pfizer are proposing to inject into us directly, and instead have used reverse transcriptase to incorporate it into a harmless human adenovirus. And that becomes the vaccine. So we get infected with that adenovirus, which causes extremely mild symptoms. That adenovirus will make its own proteins, but also that corona spike protein, because it's been engineered to do that. And it's not our own body who has to do that spike protein. And I think that's a safer path to a vaccine for COVID-19. Another company that's doing the exact same thing is Johnson & Johnson. They're using adenovirus 5 to make a vaccine. They're incorporating the corona spike gene into an adenovirus, just like the Russians. That would be a safe vaccine. Let me put it this way: a safer vaccine. In Australia, there's a company called Novavax, who's producing a vaccine that will be known as COV-2373. And what they've done is even simpler. They've purified the spike protein of the coronavirus. So it's just the protein. They have attached it to an adjuvant. An adjuvant is an immune stimulator to make the spike protein more antigenic so that our body reacts even more strongly against it, and that is their vaccine. So we'll be making, antibodies to the receptor sites of the coronavirus. The only disadvantage of that one is that it may not produce as strong of an immune response as, let's say, the Russian or the Johnson & Johnson vaccine.
Now, some of the terms you're using are a bit complicated. I wonder if you can explain them a bit more. This idea of reverse transcriptase is one of them, and this concept of having the spike, the protein spike, So could you just explain a little bit further what you mean by those two terms?
Okay. Well, reverse transcriptase is an enzyme that was discovered by Tamman in Baltimore back in 1976. Well, no, they got the Nobel Prize for it back then. They discovered it in the early 70s. I guess I would have to give you a small course in genetics. You know, our genetic material is DNA. And this DNA codes for protein, and it codes it to go from DNA to protein. You have to do messenger RNA. And this is elaborated by an enzyme called DNA-dependent RNA polymerase. And this messenger RNA goes into the ribosome of our cells and codes for all the different proteins that we make. Reverse transcriptase does the contrary. It reads RNA and makes the complementary DNA for that RNA. That's why they call it reverse transcriptase, because going from DNA to RNA is called transcription. There are a lot of viruses that are DNA viruses, and there are a lot of viruses that are RNA viruses. Some of the RNA viruses go directly and reproduce RNA to RNA. Others go through a DNA replicative stage, and they carry their own reverse transcriptase. That is the case for HIV. HIV is two strands of RNA and a few enzymes in a capsule. When HIV gets into our cell, the reverse transcriptase that it carries transforms into DNA, and this DNA is now become part of the cell that it has infected, and the cell's machine reproduces the virus. Viruses cannot reproduce on their own. They are obligate intracellular parasites because they don't have replicative mechanism. What they do, they go into a cell and colonize it and use the cell's machinery to reproduce themselves. Until there's enough in the cell lyses and it's released in the bloodstream and it infects other cells, and it's a cascading effect. Now, what they've done, so you have the coronavirus, has its RNA. That RNA codes for its coat, the coat that it needs to go from cell to cell. In that coat, or to be airborne, to infect somebody else, there is a spike, and that spike is made out of a protein coded by its RNA. It is that, and it codes for many other proteins also, but that spike protein is what attaches to cells and allows the virus to penetrate the cells. The messenger RNA that they've isolated from the genome, from the RNA of the coronavirus, is that specific messenger RNA that codes for that spike protein on the surface of the coronavirus. So if you make antibodies to it, you block its penetration of cells. You neutralize the virus. Now, have I made myself more or less clear?
Yeah, I hope so. So the idea is you make so many antibodies that there's no space on these cells for the COVID spike to get into them.
Correct. You literally put a cap on those spikes. A cap made out of the antibodies. And then there's also other things involved. The antibodies then fix complement. But what happens is that you neutralize the virus. They're neutralizing antibody. the virus can no longer, you know, infect cells. It can no longer penetrate them.
What about the T cells? Because they also come in quite, apparently they're just about as good as antibodies at stopping COVID.
That is correct. You have two kinds of, we used to call them humoral immunity, that is antibodies because they're circulating in the blood. And as you know, blood used to be called humor. So humoral immunity consists of antibodies, and cellular immunity consists of killer T cells. And that's where there's a very big danger precisely of having autoimmune diseases later on.
Now, hang on, these T cells used to be called, I think when I was a kid, white blood cells.
Well, all of them are white blood cells. Whether it's T cells, whether it's, you know, T cells are lymphocytes. There are two types of lymphocytes, B cells and T cells. But leukocytes are also white blood cells. Monocytes are white blood cells. So, yeah, they are a member of the white blood cells, population.
It's a fascinating journey you're taking us on, Stanley, and I'm sure there's a lot of our listeners who will be enjoying hearing a little bit of this, because there is an idea floating around in the mass media that we mustn't trouble the listeners and the viewers and the readers of the newspapers too much with the science. But actually, the science in all of this, of course, is absolutely crucial. I wonder, could you just take us through the different types? You've talked about the mRNA vaccine. Are there other types of vaccines which they're developing? Because many of these vaccines are of all sorts of new ideas here. I mean, for example, I believe her name is Emmanuelle Charpentier, one of the inventors of the CRISPR vaccine. These things that go and edit our genes. And the idea is they're kind of smart vaccines. They're not like smallpox and cowpox, where it's just a very simple attenuated version of the dangerous virus, that it's something which is going to go in there and try and be clever and smart, and it might snip the DNA or the RNA of a virus, but it also might go and snip in our RNA, go in and actually start altering our genes. So anyway, can you take us through these new types of vaccines being developed and what you make of them?
Well, as I was telling you, the two main alternatives that are coming out for the coronavirus now are the Russian vaccine and the Johnson & Johnson vaccines, where they're precisely using an attenuated adenovirus, human adenovirus, in which they've incorporated the protein, the part of the genome of the coronavirus, so that these adenoviruses, when they infect you with a very mild infection, you not only get immunized to them, you get immunized to the coronavirus as well. This is the basis of the Russian Sputnik V and the Johnson & Johnson virus, a vaccine. They're both using, very mild human adenoviruses as carriers of corona antigen to immunize us. And they will also elicit not only an antibody response, but also a T cell response. The other one that I was telling you about is from Australia, where they're just purifying that protein from the coronavirus, from the surface of the coronavirus, binding it with an immune stimulant, which we call adjuvant, and that is used as a virus. This, you will produce a lot of antibodies, but it will not for sure stimulate T cell response, but it will give you protection, humoral protection, antibody protection against the coronavirus. You previously asked me the difference between T-cell immunity and antibody immunity. Well, antibodies, like I told you, are produced by B lymphocytes, and they provide humoral immunity. And even when the antibody count goes down and you don't have a detectable titer of antibodies, but let's say you're challenged by that coronavirus 2 years later, you're going to get what they call a secondary response, because you form what is called memory B cells that will immediately start to produce huge quantities of antibodies, and you get a secondary response. Now, as far as T cell immunity, what the T cells do, they actually kill the infected cell that is presenting the viral antigen. And that's why I told you that there is a danger with this mRNA, with these mRNA viruses, because a lot of our cells are going to be producing the viral antigen, the viral spike protein. It will be on their membrane and the cell membrane, and our immune system is going to attack them. Yes, it will make us, it will immunize us against the coronavirus, but at the same time, a lot of our cells that will be producing that antigen will be attacked and destroyed by our killer T cells. The danger is that we don't know how many cells and how many organs will actually be producing, you know, that antigen. Because this mRNA that's being injected into us is going to be circulating in our blood, and we have no guarantee about which cells are going, of our own cells, are going to pick it up and start producing viral antigen.
Okay, so what is the thinking behind actually getting our own cells to produce the viral antigen?
Well, it's obviously a much faster track. With the gene manipulation techniques that we have now, it's very easy to identify that spike protein RNA, cleave it out, put it in what they call a liposome, and inject it into the body. You don't have to try to put it into another virus, or you don't try to attenuate the coronavirus itself. It's a real fast track way of having the body produce an immune response against that spike protein. And it's another way to, if I may say so, to have a new patent. And as you know, whether it's Moderna or Pfizer, their stock prices are shooting up in the stock exchanges. As a matter of fact, there was an article that, you know, Moderna has not produced any pharmaceutical at all. It's not that they haven't produced a vaccine before. They haven't produced any drug that's been on the market. Yet as soon as they announced their mRNA vaccine and that they were on a fast track, they were approved on a fast track to produce that vaccine, their stocks, I mean, shot up by hundreds of millions of dollars. And it seems that some of the high executives, before their vaccine was proven, I'm talking about three months ago, sold their stocks. So cashed in before they had a proven vaccine. But that's the way the new, I guess it's an example of what Naomi Klein called disaster capitalism.
In what way?
In a way that, you know, a lot of epidemics, natural disasters and stuff like this are an occasion or an opportunity for some companies to make a lot of money. And we've seen that with the history of coronavirus since the beginning. The approval, for example, the criticism of certain antiviral, certain drugs that had that were shown in vitro in scientific articles published in Nature and Lancet to have antiviral properties to inhibit the coronavirus that were denounced as fraudulent, you know, as quackery, while remdesivir was being lauded as a as an effective drug against coronavirus, which it is not. It has not saved lives. The best study they had is that, well, it retarded by 3 days the stay in hospital of patients. It lessened by 3 days hospital stays. Remdesivir is, you know, whereas drugs like ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine have been shown in vitro to seriously inhibit both extracellularly and intracellularly the coronavirus. And they are very safe drugs. It was amazing. To me, I was amazed. Back in February and March, when everybody was warning, what, hydroxychloroquine is dangerous, you know, for the heart, that it can cause terrible heart conditions, it's unsafe. A drug that's 75 years old, that hundreds of millions of people have taken, and that has saved tens of millions of lives, that was on the list of the United Nations essential drugs for humanity. We never heard about any dangers of it, you know, for the cardiovascular system until it was used for the coronavirus outbreak. The other drug that has proven effective is another antiparasitic drug, ivermectin, which has shown in vitro, within 48 hours, if you had infected tissue cultures that you treated, that you put in the nutrient fluid of these tissue cultures, ivermectin, and infected them with the Corona 2 COVID-19 virus, and a group of controls that did not have ivermectin that you're infected with the coronavirus, these tissue cultures would be totally destroyed by the coronavirus, whereas those with the ivermectin, there would be no effect and no coronavirus RNA detectable. You can find
amazing. I mean, this is incredible, isn't it? But how is it that the drug that is actually designed to be used against malaria could be useful for what is effectively a rather souped-up common cold?
Yeah, well, this is what you call serendipity. It just happened that we noticed that. Same for ivermectin. Ivermectin was developed as an anti-parasitic drug by a Japanese gentleman who got the Nobel Prize for it, by the way. And it has proven, these anti-parasitic drugs, these two anti-parasitic, have proven to be serious antiviral agents. On top of it, hydroxychloroquine has one more advantage. Here's a drug that was developed for malaria. Do you know that now chloroquine is part of the treatment for systemic lupus erythematosus and rheumatoid arthritis, because they were found to, hydroxychloroquine was found to be an excellent modulator of the immune system. So one of the ways, additional ways it helped with the corona infection is that it had antiviral, it has antiviral capacities in vitro, but it also can attenuate the cytokine storm that the virus sometimes causes, the uncontrolled immune response where a lot of cytokines and histamines are released and actually cause blood clots and respiratory failure. So how is it that a drug that was developed for malaria was found to be effective against, you know, a virus? Well, the same way it was found to be a good treatment for systemic lupus erythematosus or rheumatoid arthritis by accident.
What about the SARS? Because we all, this is something which I suppose, although many people may have heard about, you know, the mid-noughties in the news, oh, there's something called SARS flying around. We were, when this corona first started, it was actually called SARS-CoV-2. And I wonder, is this a type of coronavirus which is normal, kind of naturally occurring? What is it doing to our body? Obviously, we know that the ordinary coronavirus, the common cold, causes a lot of irritation. It makes us sneeze. It makes our nose run, this sort of thing, maybe gives us headaches, this kind of thing. But after a while, it's gone. It's pretty harmless, except maybe if you're very elderly or very sick. But what is SARS actually doing to us? Because we know that this COVID-19 actually originally was called SARS-CoV-2.
It is SARS-CoV-2. It is, you know, it's the exact same family as the SARS. You know, Corona 1.
This is okay. SARS-CoV-2. So it's a severe. I think it stands for severe advanced. What is it?
Respiratory syndrome.
Ah, that's it. Severe advanced respiratory syndrome. Yeah, but what is it doing to our body, SARS?
Well, what it does is exactly, you know, what, you know, it progresses like a flu. It first infects what we call ciliated epithelial cells, tracheal ciliated epithelial cells. And then depending on your response, depending on the individual, depending on your immune system, it can progress down to the bronchi, to the lungs, cause a severe immune response, which is as devastating as the virus itself, which we call the cytokine storm. And this is why when they've discovered that, they've also incorporated steroids in the treatment, which is an immune depressant. One would think that it's counterimaginative to use an immune depressant, you know, in a viral infection, but sometimes the immune response is more devastating precisely because you're recognizing all these infected lung cells as foreign because they're producing the viral antigen, and the immune system reacts brutally and you get a cytokine storm and you start you know, destroying your own alveoli and causing a lot of micro blood clots that can eventually lead to death.
Okay, so that's one way that SARS is in. What's going on in our blood, for example, with SARS? So can it progress into the bloodstream? I mean, I'm just quite amazed that, you know, the body would sort of overreact. You know, surely the idea is to kill off the virus, not to kill off all of our cells as well at the same time.
Yeah, well, this is not new. There are a lot of cases where our bodies, you know, by some, you know, mistake of the immune system, recognize our own cells, even without an infection, as foreign. This is what happens in rheumatoid arthritis. This is what happens in lupus. This is what happens in myasthenia gravis. That's why they're called autoimmune diseases. viruses are notorious in acting as detonators of autoimmune responses, because they infect cells, they leave their antigen on cells, on cell membranes, and even after the virus itself is no longer active, viruses are notorious in causing, you know, immune responses that, you know, that can very much affect us. And I'm sure you're familiar with Guillain-Barré syndrome, Bell's palsy. These are, you know, neurological autoimmune diseases that affect us because a virus deposited its antigen and our bodies began to recognize our own cells as foreign to be attacked.
Is that what you're saying, that we may get the same kind of autoimmune response tricking our immune system into attacking our own cells with the mRNA vaccine?
Yes, that's exactly what I've been saying. It may, and long after the virus is gone, as a matter of fact, we were not even exposed to the virus, even if we're, you know, we're producing an antigen which is foreign, which our immune system will recognize as foreign. I would rather be immunized with a virus that, like an adenovirus, that was programmed to produce that antigen instead of programming my own cells to produce that antigen.
Why?
Why? Well, because, you know, my own cells producing that antigen, my cells become the virus. My cells become more recognizable as foreign by my immune system.
Okay, so what with this, all these technologies now on the horizon, would you yourself have one of these new types of vaccines, I wonder? Because there's some people, particularly young people I speak to, say we don't want any kind of vaccine to this. Actually, what I like doing is I like catching these and I like training my own immune system to deal with viruses in a natural way. So when they come along, I might be ill, I might be quite sick. But it's quite nice to have a naturally trained immune system, which is dealing with any kind of disease and pathogen as it comes along, rather than trying to say, well, I'm going to train it in an artificial manner in order to deal with a specific virus. So anyway, what do you make of that argument that says that, you know, what we should be really doing, particularly younger people, is simply catching things, you know, actually even going out of our way to catch things, to train our immune system to be ready for anything that comes along?
Well, that is a valid argument for a young person and for diseases such as the flu or perhaps a simple corona infection. But that is not true. They would be under the wrong impression, because for things like poliomyelitis or smallpox, that would not be a very good idea. Thank God for immunization. Thank God for Jenning and Pasteur, who started that, because there are three things that saved really hundreds of millions of lives and made life expectancy a lot longer. You had immunization, which we call vaccination because it got this name from cowpox, which was first used to immunize against smallpox. So you have vaccination, antibiotics, and chlorine, the chemical chlorine. Chlorine made water that was unsafe, that carried cholera, that carried a lot of other diseases. Even in the fight against malaria, chlorine was useful because chlorinated water, the larvae of the mosquitoes, of the Anopheles mosquitoes, would die in chlorinated water. So you can imagine the millions and millions and millions of lives that have been saved with vaccination, with antibiotics, and with water treatment with chlorine. But just like everything else, you can exaggerate things. For example, with antibiotics, bacteria are reacting. They have their own natural selection, and they're evolving into all kinds of antibiotic-resistant bacteria. So it's a constant fight. Same for immunization. This is why I myself, I don't take the, even though I'm at the age where they say it's most important to take the flu vaccine, I don't. Because the flu changes every year, and I haven't seen any correlation between percentage of people vaccinated with the flu and a decrease, in flu cases. And 2007 was notorious for that. But certain vaccines, you know, would be, I think, obligatory. For example, your tetanus vaccine. I mean, are you going to let your body get naturally immune to the tetanus toxin? I don't think that's a good idea. As far as the corona is concerned, let's face it, this is something that has a mortality rate of 1% or less. I don't think it's as grave as we're reacting. Some of the young people who think that shutdowns, shutting down and infringing upon their liberties because of that virus may have a point there. But then to say that, well, I'm anti any kind of vaccine is the wrong reaction.
Will you be taking one of these vaccines?
No, I will not be taking an mRNA vaccine for sure. And I will not advise my family members, young family members, to take it either. The adenovirus vaccine, maybe, if herd immunity doesn't get rid of this epidemic before they become available.
Okay, so your whole approach to this seems to be very, very well educated. Can you just tell us again a little bit about your contribution to this, and how come you know quite a bit about the topic?
Well, as I told you, my doctoral dissertation consisted in discovering a new virus. I was working after my doctoral qualifying exams. I was working with tissue cultures that we thought were infected with the rhabdovirus. This is the rabies virus. But I was seeing formations and pathogenesis that was not associated with, that could not be explained with the rabies virus. So I investigated, I isolated a new virus of the retroviridae family, retrovirus, which, like I told you, is the same family as the AIDS virus, HIV, and of the subfamily Spumavirinae. So I've been working, I spent, you know, years working with viruses, tissue cultures, isolating them, proving that there are any viruses, as opposed to a DNA virus, doing reverse transcriptase assay. When reverse transcriptase assay was a long and laborious thing in the 70s, so many new techniques. Technologically, there have been incredible advances that permit genetic manipulations that were not possible back in the 70s. It's not so much basic scientific dogma discoveries in biology or genetics. It's more incredible techniques that have been developed. For example, the tests that they do now for what they call the RT-PCR tests with the swabs. RT stands for reverse transcriptase and PCR for polymerase chain reaction. Now, the gentleman who elaborated the polymerase chain reaction technique got the Nobel Prize for it in 1988, the Nobel Prize of Medicine and Physiology. And that permits us to take a small piece of DNA and multiply it a million times. Most of the advances that we are having in genetic engineering are thanks to this technique, the polymerase chain reaction. Now, this, it did not exist when I was getting my doctorate in 1978.
So, what about this PCR test? Is it reliable? Is it being used correctly, deployed in the population in the right manner?
Do you want me to give you an honest answer? The honest answer is, I don't know. That theoretically it should work, but unfortunately, I don't know what is going wrong. I don't know if it's through I don't know, corruption, people, labs that are claiming that they can do it and that are not doing it adequately. But unfortunately, there have been false positives and false negatives. A lot of them. But
there seems to have been a lot of effort put into this particular type of test. Would it have maybe been better to use a different test?
Well, I was always advocating for the antibody tests, what they call immunodiffusion tests, where, you know, these are very simple tests where you get a result in half an hour, where you put the serum of the patient to be tested in a well, and you put the antigen in another well, and then you see if you get an antibody precipitation band. I did a lot of that with the virus. I developed quite a few, you know, antibody diffusion tests for the virus that I discovered, so I could test when I experimentally infected animals with it, so that I could test if the infection really went on. And it was almost 100% accurate. But, you know, they say when you have a new toy, you tend to use it, especially if it's an expensive toy. But I have to say that PCR is an incredible technique, which I wish we had back in the 70s when I was doing my viral researches.
But is it you know, actually being deployed in the right manner across the population? And for example, you know, they're using it apparently to try and test everyone in Liverpool, for example.
Let me tell you some of the things that are wrong with it. First of all, in order for you to test positive, when they swab you, they have to be taking enough viral RNA from your nasopharynx, and then they put it, this is the first part, RT/PCR, they incubate it with a reverse transcriptase, which turns that RNA into DNA. Then they use the PCR, which is the DNA polymerase chain reaction, to multiply it a millionfold so that it's detectable. Now, I could go get tested at a time, let's suppose I am positive, but at that time I had no viral DNA in my throat, viral RNA in my throat. So it will give a false negative. It's possible that one was infected a long time ago and you still have some remnant of this RNA, and it gives you a positive while really you've been over it. So this test should be complemented with a simple antibody test that shouldn't cost more than $5 to do, an antibody precipitation test. Because if your PCR test is positive, within 2 weeks after that, you should be antibody positive. So I think one should be supplemented with the other.
What do you make of this idea of mandating these treatments, the vaccine particularly? And there are also conspiracy theories as well circulating about a kind of almost a medical dictatorship. You know, the idea that people using this pandemic in order to make a lot of money by forcing vaccines on people that might, they might not otherwise wish to have. So what do you make of this whole idea of mandating?
Mandating for the corona COVID-19 vaccine is unacceptable as far as I'm concerned. It should be completely voluntary. There is this idea that they're accusing people, well, if you don't get vaccinated, it's not just you, you're putting me in danger. That is fallacious reasoning, because if you are vaccinated, I'm certainly not putting you in danger. Your vaccine should protect you, even if you think that I might be contagious.
Yeah. You know, I imagine that when you were at university, you had some sort of guide in ethics. So, because there are quite a few doctors who are saying that this is an ethical dilemma here. That there should be a much that we should be taking much more different steps rather than going towards mandating. So, I just wonder what you make of this whole idea, this move towards saying that people may have to have this vaccine, for example, if they want to travel.
This is the problem. This is the great problem, where you could be forced into getting vaccinated by restricting your movements if you elect not to be vaccinated. That is a problem. It's an ethical, it's a political, and it's a civil liberties problem. Like I said, there were some vaccines that I, as an immunologist, think are extremely necessary. For example, the DPT vaccine that we give to kids, you know, diphtheria, pertussis, tetanus, I think are lifesavers. But with this, just like the flu vaccine, this corona vaccine, this corona epidemic has been used to make billions, even hundreds of billions of dollars by pharmaceutical companies who have up to now given us nothing. And I took the example of Moderna, where their stocks went up by billions even before we knew if anything was going to be produced. And a company that has never, ever put a drug out for anything, even for a headache. As soon as Dr. Anthony Fauci gave it his blessings, their stocks shot up. And same for the remdesivir.
as an antiviral drug. Yes, it has been used. This pandemic has been used to make a lot of money in a very, very unethical fashion.
And what about the $64,000 question, Stanley, which is this, and could this be a man-made engineered virus? I mean, we'll leave aside the idea that it was, you know, released from a lab accidentally or on purpose, but do you think, what do you think it is the possibility that the COVID-19 was actually a man-made thing that got released?
Well, I don't think it's something that was released on purpose, but could it be, a genetically modified coronavirus that accidentally got released? Yes, that possibility does exist. It's a very plausible possibility, because back in the 70s, we knew four serotypes of coronavirus. By the way, there was an epidemiological study done in 1974 where they found that 25% of kids between the ages of 7 and 14 years old had antibodies to one of the serotypes of coronavirus. And they were totally harmless. It passed as, you know, maybe a cold or something. But 25% of kids in the United States between the ages of 7 and 14 tested positive, seropositive, for one of the corona strains that we knew back then. And they've been in the laboratory, and a lot of laboratories are using them. The United States has worked on a bunch of, especially during the period of the Cold War, some biological horrors that, but laboratories do that, you know, all over. They mutate viruses, they add gene, genetic engineering, the new techniques that exist that allows us to take, you know, splice genes and transmutate viruses. They're done in laboratories. The genie is out of the bottle. So was this one a naturally occurring mutation from a bat, or was it genetically modified in a laboratory? Both are 50-50% possibilities.
Is there anywhere we can find your work if people are interested in, following up, having a look at some of the work that you've done?
Well,
I think there's quite a lot of people out there, my impression is, that are fed up with the mass media really treating the public like they have no scientific background, that they're basically children, and that we're just going to tell them that this is good for them and we're not going to bother to explain why.
I don't know what to tell you. If you want, actually, when I did my work, the internet was not, there was no internet. But surprisingly, back in 2010, I received a letter from the University of Florida asking me permission to put my doctoral dissertation online and if I would agree to release my copyright. By the way, I didn't even know I had a copyright on my doctoral dissertation. So, of course, I gave it to them free of charge. And so, yes, my doctoral dissertation is available online.
And what about your comments and commentary on this outbreak?
I have some comments and commentaries that you can find on the website called ResearchGate, where a lot of scientists make commentaries, and of course on my Facebook page.
Finally, Stan, where do you think we'll be in a year's time?
I think in a year's time, we will have, I think this virus itself will be an attenuated virus. And I think we will be over it, but the new laws and restrictions that have been implemented during this pandemic will be a precedent to to repeat this control. There will have been a precedent for a population control.
Okay, Stanley Layam, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.